recording. Okay, this is the Cheskel Shir Ilu Nishmosim Ephraim Shmuel Ben Avram Aryeh HaKohen and Chaya Tova Bas Eliezer Mendel HaKohen on the book of Yecheskel. This shir is dedicated also to all our soldiers. We are holding in Yecheskel chapter 14, verses 15 and 16. Yecheskel, or God, through Yecheskel, is discussing the four methods by which God brings curse to the world, curses, trouble, trauma, suffering, punishment. And last time we dealt with the first one, which was famine, and now we're on to punishment too. All these four will affect Yerushalayim, one by one, all at the same time. They'll come one by one, but they'll affect Yerushalayim at the same time. And this is wild animals, Chayas Ra'as, as reminding you, as the Malbim pointed out in his introduction to this chapter, what the category of wild animals also includes natural disasters like violent weather, floods, earthquakes, volcanoes, eruptions, tsunamis, etc., etc. So now God says, in verses 15 and 16, Luchaya Ra'a Avir Ba'aretz, if I would bring or would cause wild beasts to pass through the land, vishiklato, and cause them to depopulate the land, v'hoisa shimom bli over mipnei achaya, it would become desolate without even a passerby because of those wild beasts. But shloshis anoshim o'ela, even if these three men, and we're talking about the three men we discussed last week, Daniel, Noach, Daniel, and Eov, Shloshis HaAnashim HaEla B'Socha, even if these three men would be inside the city, Chai Ani, God swears, as I live, Ne'um HaShem Elokim, God says, in Bonim V'in Bonos Yatzila, they would be unable to save even their sons and their daughters, Heimel Levadom Yinotzela, they would only be able to save themselves, and the land would become desolate. So here is the second type of punishment that God brings to the world. Wild animals, which again, it's a euphemism that also includes natural disasters. And God is describing what will happen from our perspective, what has already happened to Yehuda and to Yerushalayim after the Babylonians came, that after the wild animals came into the land during the destruction of Yerushalayim, we'll see who the wild animals are in a second, land would then remain desolate and depopulated with no one even daring to pass through it. So who is the higher Ra'a? Who is this wild beast that God is referring to here? So the Baal Ranel says, tells you straight away, Achaya Ra'a Shehi Nebuchadnezzar, the wild animal what God's referring to here, that's going to cause all the trouble in Yerushalayim, is Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylonia, Melech Bovel, Giyua Nikra Aryeh. He is described by Jeremiah as the great lion in the Pasuk, in the verse in Yirmiah, in chapter 4, verse 7. Ola Aryeh Misubko, a lion has come forth from his thicket. Umashchis Goyim, he's a destroyer of nations. Nosa Yotzom Imkomo, he has traveled from his place, Losum Artsech Lashamo, to make your land into a wasteland, Orayach Titzeno Me'en Yoshev, to make your cities desolate, without Me'en Yoshev, and no, with no inhabitants. And Nebuchadnezzar is the wild animal. So that is verse 15. That's the idea here of the higher Ra, Avir Ba'oretz, the wild animal passing through the land that's referred to Nebuchadnezzar. And in verse 16, God says that regarding this attack of the Babylonians under this wild animal, Nebuchadnezzar, Shloshes HaAnashim HaEla B'Socha, even if these three men, and again, Noach, Daniel, and Eov, we discussed this in great detail last week. You can refer to the shir from last week to understand why Eov is included in this list. Even if these three great men, Noach, Daniel, and Iyov, would have been in Yerushalayim, in Bonim, but in Bonus Yatzila, says the prophet. They would be able to save. Now, there's two ways of reading this verse. If you go back to verse 16, there are two ways of reading this verse. So let me just read it to you again. If these three men would have been inside the city, I swear, says God, you can read that as an oath that God's taking, that they wouldn't be able to save their sons and daughters, or they would be able to save their sons and daughters. Now, if you read it the second way, that they wouldn't be able to save, that they would be able to save their children, then the next part of the verse doesn't make any sense, because it says, Hema levadam yinot zeilim, they alone would be saved, v'ha'oretz tiyeshimama, and the land would remain desolate. So the proper way to read this verse is this, Shloshes anashim ha'elef b'socha, if these three men were inside the city of Yerushalayim, Chai onin um Hashem Elokim, I swear, says God, in bonim v'im bonos yatzila, one of them would have been able to save their children. Hema, the other two, levadom yinot zeilim, the other two would only have been able to save themselves, v'ha'oretz tiyeh shemama, and then the land would have remained desolate. So who is the one? Who is the one that would have been able to save his children? So the Malbim points out that this statement, imbonim v'imbonos yatzila, the Malbim says this statement refers to Noach. Noach had the ability to save his sons and daughters. And as the Malbim says this, it's one of the subcategories of wild animals, is a natural disaster. And so that in relation to Noach, if he was in Yerushalayim and subject to the invasion of Nebuchadnezzar, he alone would have been able to save his own family, including his wife and his children, because at the time of the flood, he did manage to save his family. Not only that, but as we'll see below and shortly, Noah and his whole family were saved from real wild animals as well. Not only were they saved from the flood, they were saved from real wild animals as well. So it's a natural disaster, and they were saved from natural disaster and from real wild animals. But the other two, Hema levadam yinot zeilim, the other two, Daniel and Iyov, they wouldn't have been able to save anybody else, because Daniel and Iyov were both struck by chaya ra. They were both struck by wild animals, as we'll see in a moment, and they only had the ability to save themselves and not anyone else. So how were each of these three great men, Noach, let me just mute everybody again. How exactly were these three tzaddikim, Noach, Daniel, and Iyov, saved from chaya ra, from wild animals? So Noach, this category of wild animals, again, includes natural disasters, but Noach was actually saved not only from the flood, but from wild animals as well. In terms of wild animals, when Noah entered the ark, the Medrash says that many wild beasts attempted to enter. Remember, only a certain amount of animals were taken into the ark. The animals went in two by two, hurrah, which is the old song. But you can imagine, you know, the two lions went in, the two bears went in, a lot of the other animals wanted to get in. But God didn't allow them to get in. And it says in Bereshis, Vayiskor Hashem Ba'ado, that these animals were trying to get in as the rain started to come down, and God closed off the entrance around him, around Noah. And the Medrash says that, what does it mean by Yizgar Hashem Ba'ado? God closed the ark for him, around him. And the Medrash says, this is the Medrash in Bereshis, Medrash Rabbah in Bereshis, that if any of the wild animals, the lions or the tigers or bears, just to quote the Jungle Book, if any of the lions and tigers and bears, it's not the Jungle Book, it's a Wizard of Oz. If any of the lions and tigers and bears attempted to enter the ark by force, its teeth would become dull and it would be forced to retreat. And that's what it means by Yizgar Hashem Ba'adam. When God closed the entrance to the ark around him, it prevented any of the animals getting in and attacking Noach. So Noach was not only saved from the flood, which was a natural disaster, he was also saved from wild animals as well, as the Midrash pointed out. But the thing about Noach was, he didn't just manage to save himself, he managed to save his family, his wife, his children, his daughters-in-law, according to the Medrash also, Og Melech HaBoshon was on the roof of the ark as well. So they were all saved. When it came to Daniel, what we see with Daniel was also saved from wild animals. That's the famous story. In chapter 6 of Daniel, we find him being saved from wild animals. We find him as an advisor to King Darius the Mede. The story is, just to give you a brief background to the story, Daniel's rivals, Daniel rose in prominence in both the Babylonian Empire and also after that in the Persian Empire. He was a chief advisor to the king, but as is often the case, when you get to the top, so there's plenty of people that want to knock you off. And if you're Jewish, it's even harder. So Daniel had many jealous rivals, and they tricked Darius the Mede into issuing a decree that for 30 days, no prayer should be addressed to any god or man, but to Darius himself. And anyone who disobeyed this edict was to be thrown to the lions. Hence the story of Daniel in the lion's den. But of course, Daniel continued to pray daily to God and the king, and they caught him. They set a trap for him, and they caught him out davening. And the king, although deeply distressed because he was a very close friend of Daniel, was forced to condemn Daniel to death. And he prayed, actually. It's a very strange thing that Darius the Mede prayed for Daniel's deliverance, and he was cast into the pit. With the lions, and they closed the roof, or they closed up the pit, and at daybreak, the king wakes up very early and runs to the place, to the lion's den, and cries out anxiously, asking God if he's saved his friend Daniel. And Daniel replies that God had sent an angel to close the jaws of the lion. And Darius commands that those who had conspired against Daniel were to be thrown into the lions in his place with their wives and children, and the whole world should tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. That's the background to that story. So Daniel was saved, but he had no one else to save. There's no, as the, this verse says quite clearly, that Hamor, Daniel, and Eov, Levadom, you not save them. They only had the ability to save themselves. From wild animals or from natural disasters, whereas Noah had the ability to save both himself and his family. The third member of this crew is Eov, of course. How was Eov saved from wild animals? So it says, very strange pasuk in Eov, in the first chapter of Eov, first chapter of Job, it says, "Umiknehu poratz ba'aretz." And Eov, this is the time when Eov was, you know, a very wealthy man, he had everything going for him, and then suddenly things started to turn against him. And it says, "Umiknehu poratz ba'aretz." Eov's cattle broke out into the land. And the Gemara in Baba Basra on Daf Tesvob, on page 15, Tesvob on the base, page 15b, explains what this verse means. "Umiknehu poratz ba'aretz." Eov's cattle broke out into the land. The Gemara says, "Amar Rabbi Yosi bar Chanina," that in the name of Rabbi Yosi bar Chanina, they say Eov's livestock breached porotsu. This language of porats, porotsu, they broke the natural order of the world. And the Gemara says it's the way of the world that wolves kill goats. But in the case of Eov's livestock, his goats became very violent and had the ability to kill the wolves, and naturally had the ability to kill human beings. but God protected Eov from the violence of his own stock, of his own flock. So we see that from that Medrash, it's a strange Medrash that in the Gemara and Bava Basra, but we see that Eov and Daniel were saved from wild animals and unable to save others, but as we know with Eov, all his family ended up dead. Daniel had no one else to save, but Noach managed to save his own family as well as himself from this curse, this second curse of wild animals and natural disasters. Punishment number three that will affect Yerushalayim is the cherev, is the sword. And that is dealt with in verses 17 and 18. And it says God, again, the same format, O cherev, ovi el ha'oretz ahi. Or when I, God, bring a sword upon that land, the amarti, and I say, cherev tabar ba'oretz, let the sword pass through the land, v'hichrati mimena odom v'hema, and let it cut off from it both man and beast. And verse 18, u'shloshes anoshim o'eila v'socha, and had these three men been in Yerushalayim when the sword came, chay ani no'om Hashem Elokim. God makes the shvur again, another oath. God says, by my life, lo yatzilu bonim uvonos, ki heim levadam yinotzelim. Under these circumstances, none of them, not Noach, not Daniel, and not Eov, would have been able to save anybody else, not their children, not their wives. They would only have been able to save themselves. So, yet again, in verse 18, we see God makes a shvur. It's very in Chai Hashem. This language of Chai Hashem takes a lot of understanding. And we're not going to go into it because we can be talking about this for a whole shiur. The language of Chai Ani. When God says Chai Ani as I live, so what does that mean? Does God live? Live is something that we understand in the context of a physical universe, that everything in it is transient. God is not transient, therefore to use the word exist or live when you're talking about God, so it's a bit strange. It's really out of context. But again, it's the subject of another shir. But God says, makes the shavua, these three, if I would have brought the sword into Yerushalayim and these three guys would have been there, yeah, they'd have been able to save themselves, but they'd never been able to save anybody else. Now, Noach, how was Noach saved by the sword? So, the Medrash says, and the Pasuk says, the Medrash, at the time of the flood, when the people of the generation, you remember that Noach gave warning about the flood for 120 years. And people mocked him, told him he was talking out of his hat, and but all of a sudden, you know, after 120 years, so it started to rain. And when the people of the generation saw that Noah and his family were getting on the ark, the people of the generation tried to get to Noah and kill him and destroy the ark. And as the Pasuk says, God had other ideas. And this is what happened. This is the words of the Torah in Bereishis. This is chapter 7. Of Bereishis in relation to Noach, chapter 7, verse 13. Ve'etzem hayom hazeh, bo Noach v'shem v'chom v'yopas b'nei Noach. On that very day, ve'etzem, in the bone of that day, in the light of that day, in the middle of that day, they didn't get into the ark in the middle of the night. They didn't sneakily jump on the ark in the middle of the night. Ve'etzem hayom hazeh, in midday. Bon Noach, v'shem v'chom v'yofes b'nei Noach, Noach and his children, shem chom and yofes, v'eishas Noach and Noach's wife, u'shloshes m'shei bonov and his three daughters-in-law, itom el ha'tevor, they got into the ark. And Rashi says, on the words, v'etzem hayom hazeh, what does it mean on this very day? Now the word etzem means a bone. It implies some type of violence. So Rashi says, "Lamedcha hakosav shehoyu b'nei dora omrim," that when they saw in midday, as it, the brightest part of the day. So no one was in any doubt what was going on, that Noach was getting onto the ark with his children. Ilu Onu Rom also Nichnas Lateva. If we see this fellow Noach trying to get onto the ark, Onu Shovrin also Vahorgin also, will destroy the ark and will kill him. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God says, Ani Machnis La'eni Kulam V'nira Devar Mi Yokum. God says, I'll bring him, not anybody else, I will bring him safely onto the ark before your eyes, and you will see who will prevail. And we know who prevailed. That's the Medrash, the Sifrei in Hazinu. So we see the idea of Noah. Not only was he safe from the flood, he was, as we just discussed before, the animals tried to get to him, the wild animals tried to get to him, and also the people of his own generation tried to kill him. And obviously they were desperately trying to kill him and destroy the ark, and they didn't succeed. So we see Noah was safe from the sword. What about Daniel? When was Daniel safe from the sword? So we know with Daniel was taken into Babylonia in the exile of King Yechoniah. Now, the exile of King Yechoniah, we've discussed this in great detail in the early chapters of Yechezkel. That took place 11 years before the destruction of the first temple. In the first wave, there was various waves of expulsions from Yehuda, the land of Yehuda and Yerushalayim, by the Babylonians. And Daniel was taken as a young boy in the first wave, 11 years before the destruction of the temple. And about 6 years prior to this, or 5 years, or 6 years prior to this prophecy. And he was taken together with, it was a who's who of the Jews of the land of Israel at the time. It was Yechezkel, our current prophet, Mordechai, Esther, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, Ezra, all these guys. And of course he became, as we discussed earlier, he became a very high-ranking officer as he grew up. He became a high-ranking officer in Nebuchadnezzar's government. And again, suppose he retained when the Persians conquered the Babylonians after the reigns of Nebuchadnezzar first, the first king of Babylon. He died. He was succeeded by his son, Evil-Merodach, who was a good man, a decent chap. And then he was succeeded by Belshazzar, the third and final Babylonian king. And remember, he was assassinated the night of his party. He made a big party, and with the incident of the writing on the wall, when the writing on the wall took place, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin, Daniel interpreted the message that you've been weighed and found wanting, and the Persians are coming, and the Persians came and assassinated Belshazzar. That signaled the end of the Babylonian Empire. But getting back to the first expulsion, from Yehuda that took place 11 years before the destruction of the temple, it was not as violent, obviously, as the one that occurred when the Beis Hamikdash was eventually destroyed, but nevertheless caused the death by the sword of thousands of Jews. And this is something that Daniel was spared from. Daniel was saved from the sword when he was taken into exile, when the first wave of Jews were taken into exile by Nebuchadnezzar 11 years before the temple was destroyed, and about 5 years before this prophecy is being given to, or 6 years, not quite clear when this prophecy took place, either 5 or 6 years before this prophecy that Yechezkel is experiencing. So we know that Noah was saved from the sword, we know that Daniel was saved from the sword. What about Eov? When was Eov saved from the sword? So in Eov, in chapter 16, it describes how Eov was attacked and injured by arrows and other handheld weapons. This is the part of Eov, by the way, that is very, very difficult to understand. The first maybe 7, 8 chapters we can deal with comfortably with our commentators and the last few chapters as well. It's the chapters that are in between that are very, very difficult to deal with. The language is very difficult to deal with, and the message is very hard to understand. But here he describes, Eov is describing himself. He's in trouble. He says, Yosobo alai raboth, archers surround me. Yifalach kul yosai, velo yachmo. They hit me. The arrows hit me and split my kidneys. And my enemy has no compassion. Yishkof la'oretz merei rossi. And my gallbladder is spilling out into the ground. So he sounds like he's in a bad way. He's in real big trouble there. He's been hit with arrows to his kidneys, and his gallbladder is spilled out of his body onto the ground. I know it's not a nice bit of imagery. Try not to imagine it. But the Gemara says quite clearly that Eov survived these normally fatal injuries miraculously. He survived them so he could suffer more. I mean, this is the Satan at work. But he survived the sword. He survived the arrows and a normally fatal injury. Exactly what it means, exactly what the story was. So you'll have to read Eov and try and understand what Rashi's getting at there. But the Gemara says clearly that Eov was attacked as a result of the actions of the Satan. And he suffered injuries that would normally be fatal, but he recovered, as we know he recovered, because there's plenty more chapters. This is in chapter 16. We have to get to the end of the book, and where he gets to speak to God. And so the God says here, Kihem levadam yinat seilu. If they would have been, if these three, Eov, Noach, Daniel, and Eov, would have been in Yerushalayim, yes, they would have been, and when the sword came into Yerushalayim, they alone would have been saved. And again, God makes the point that had these three tzaddikim been in Yerushalayim, they would not have had the ability to save anyone else. Even with their own righteousness, they wouldn't have been unable to protect anyone else in the city, including their own families. Well, what's interesting here that some of the Mefarshim make the analogy to Sodom and Gomorrah, and the story of Abraham and Avraham begging God to save the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. If there's 50 righteous men, would you save the city? God says, yes, if you can find 50, I won't destroy them. What about 40? What about 30? What about 20? What about 10? So you couldn't find any. Couldn't find any tzaddikim in the city. And the reality is, the message from the story, the essential message from the story of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, is that Sodom and Gomorrah were not destroyed because there was a million evil people in the city. Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed because they couldn't find any righteous people in the city. And had there been any righteous people in the city would have been saved. That was the idea. Yerushalayim is treated differently, because here we see that Yerushalayim is not going to be saved even if these three giants were there, never mind just regular tzaddikim, even if Noach and Daniel and Eov were in the city would not have been spared. So the punishment that's going to come down to Yerushalayim, in a certain sense, is even more God's anger, so to speak, is even more virulent against Yerushalayim on the one hand. On the one hand, Sodom and Gomorrah could have been saved by the presence of tzaddikim. Yerushalayim could not have been saved by the presence of tzaddikim. On the other hand, Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed forever. They were never rebuilt. Whereas Yerushalayim has got a future. Despite the fact that the Babylonians are going to burn it to the ground, Yerushalayim is going to be rebuilt once, and it's going to be destroyed again, and it's going to be rebuilt again, and the Beis Hamikdash, of course, is going to be rebuilt again. B'mheirah b'yameinu. Again, that's the third curse. The third curse is the curse of the sword. And the final curse, in verses 19 and 20, is the fourth curse, the curse of the plague. And that will, this again is going to affect you. Shalim, plague, pandemic, disease, which is a natural, something that follows on naturally from a siege. You have a siege and there's famine and death, and the thing that follows all these things is plague. Terrible disease. There's no food, no sanitation. There's dead bodies lying in the street. So the next thing that's going to happen is Deborah. The next thing that's going to happen is plague, pestilence. I don't like that word, pestilence. It's a biblical word, an English biblical word. Plague, pandemic, disease. So he says, this is verses 19 and 20. O Deborah, shalach ala oretzahi. Or if I send plague, pandemic, to the land. V'shofach ticham osi olea badom. And I pour out my fury upon it, upon the city, with blood, lahachris mimeno odon ubehema, to destroy from it both man and beast. The Noach, Daniel, the Eob, the Socha. And again, if Noach, Daniel, and Eob were present, again, chai oni na'om Hashem Elokim. God says, I swear, in ben, in bath, yatzilu, heima b'tzidkosim, yatzilu nafshom. They wouldn't have a son or a daughter that they would be able to save. They, with their righteousness, would only be able to save themselves. Now here we reach a bit of a crossroads here, because regarding the previous three categories of suffering, which was famine, wild animals, natural disasters, and the third one was the sword, which we've just discussed, we found that each of these three individuals, Noach, Daniel, and Eov, were saved from each of these three. We discussed in detail in the previous verses in this chapter that both, all three of them, Noach, Daniel, and Eov, each of them was saved from famine, each of them was saved from wild animals, and Noach was saved from a natural disaster, and all three of them were saved from the sword. However, when it comes to Deborah, when it comes to plague, we don't find that either Noach or Daniel were affected by this form of suffering, by this form of curse, during their lives. The only one of the three that suffered from Deborah, from plague, from some type of terrible disease, was Eov. Eov, on the other hand, suffered terrible physical ailments. As it says in Eov, Eov is very specific and very explicit about what the Satan did to Eov. It says here, this is chapter 2, verse 7. In the book of Job, in the book of Eov, the Satan departed from the presence of God, in parentheses, with permission to do what he liked to Eov. And he hit Eov with severe boils, mikaf raglo v'ad kod kodko, from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. He got he had bubonic plague. That's just the starter. I don't want to go into all the stuff that he had to suffer. But you know, he had the plague and, everything else bad happened to him. So that he ended up, from the position he was in as a wealthy, philanthropist, who didn't miss a mincha, with a beautiful family, to someone who was sitting naked, covered in boils, sitting on the top of a dung heap, with all these diseases. So he's really the only one of these three that suffered from this. We don't find the other two, Noach and Daniel, suffering from any type of disease. So I think it's appropriate to suggest that these two verses here, these two verses here, 19 and 20, which deal with the curse of the plague coming to Yerushalayim, which it did, just to suggest that the story of Eov is the primary story we should be looking at here, and what we can learn from his horrendous experiences of physical trauma as a parallel to the plague, sickness, and pandemics that would affect Yerushalayim during the siege by the Babylonian army. What was it that Eov did that brought upon him such physical suffering that the people of Yerushalayim should have learned from, but didn't? So, it's interesting that, what did Eov do? Well, I mean, it seems from a simple reading of the book of Eov that, you know, this seemed like a game, right? The game was, you know, it's almost, you know, a novel, a made-up story where, you know, God's sitting there and he's talking to the Satan, and God says to the Satan, he deliberately winds up the Satan, he says to him, have you seen my man Eov? What a tremendous guy I've got there. He's wonderful, and he's this, and he davens, and he puts tefillin on, and he gives the docker, and he visits the sick, and he makes kiddush, and he does everything. My man. He's my man. That Eov. He's my best man. And the Satan says, yeah, very good. You know, anyone can be like that. You've got 50 million in the bank, and he's got a, you know, a family, a holiday home on Palm Beach, and everything he touches turns to gold. Now let's see how much he loves you, and let's see what you got to say about him if he suffers tragedy. So God says, all right, you know, take everything away, do what you like to him, and let's see. I my bet is he'll still praise me, which is a very, very strange story. Which, again, one of the reasons why the Rambam writes, which we discussed last week in the Moreh Nevuchim, in the third section of the Moreh Nevuchim, that he believes that it is a story, that it's lo hayah v'lo nivra, that there was no individual called Eov, and of course we discussed that in great detail last week. So what was it? What was it on a much deeper level, not the simplistic just reading of the text? What was it that brought Eov such tremendous physical suffering and something that the people of Yerushalayim should have learned from, but they didn't? So I think the starting point here, and this is really, I'm going out on a limb here trying to explain it. I didn't see this in any of the other commentaries. This is really my understanding of it, and I'll bring some support from my opinion from the Briskerov, Reb Velvel, in a second. But I think the starting point is the Gemara in Sota. There's a Gemara in Sota on Daf Yud Aleph, and the Gemara says there, in the name of Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, he says three noteworthy people were consulted by Paro. Everybody knows this Medrash. Three noteworthy, this is a Medrash that's brought by Rashi, by the way, on last week's Parasha, when Paro was deciding what to do with the Jewish people. And the Gemara says that three noteworthy people from the generation were consulted by Paro and questioned about what should be done with the Jewish people living in Egypt. Remember, by Yochum Melech Chodosh, there was a new king in Egypt. Either it was a brand new king, or it was a king that didn't recognize Yosef, didn't recognize his decrees and his laws, and changed the whole constitution of Egypt and decided to imprison the Jewish people. But he couldn't decide what to do with it. Should we kill them? What should we do with these people? They've multiplied and they're a danger. Maybe they'll revolt against us. If there's an enemy and they're attacked, they'll take on the good questions. Maybe they'll become a fifth column, and we've got to do something about these Jews. So he consulted, the Medrash says he consulted three contemporary people, well-known individuals in the world, who were currently alive. Who were they? They were Bilam, Yisroel, and Eov, which gives credence to the Gemara we learned last week, that Eov lived during that time, lived during the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. Anyway, not going back to discuss Eov again, you can refer to last week's Shia. So the Medrash says that Pharaoh spoke to Bilam, Yisroel, and Eov. And the Medrash says as follows, in the name of Rav Chiya bar Abba, what occurred what was the advice that each of these three men gave, and what was the result of what they said? So Bilam advised Pharaoh to kill all the sons born to the Jewish people, and that was his advice. One Medrash says he advised Pharaoh, the Pharaoh, to kill all the boys. Some say he advised Pharaoh to kill everybody, to kill all the Jews. Two ways of reading the Medrash. In any event, he said kill the Jews. And he ended up, his punishment was that he was killed in the war with Midian later on in the Torah. He was killed by Pinchas, and that was the end of him. The second guy, Yisro, he wanted the Jews protected. He ran away as a sign of protest against Pharaoh's malicious intent towards the Jews. And his reward, he told Pharaoh, "You don't. What are you killing innocent people for?" And Pharaoh got angry with him, and he ran off. He ran back to Midian. And his reward for defending the Jews, or defending the lives of the Jews, that he merited, obviously, that his daughter married Moshe Rabbeinu, and as a result of that, some of his descendants sat in the Sanhedrin, which the Gemara goes into detail. The Gemara in Sota discusses that one opinion in the Gemara is that after the Torah was given, Yisro converted, and some of his descendants lived in the land of Israel, in the plain of Jericho. One of his descendants was Yael. Remember the story of Yael and the tent peg? She put the tent peg in Sisera's head, the general of the Canaanite army. And they were converts to Judaism. That's hence why Yael, even though Yael technically is not a Jewish name, it's become a very popular Jewish name. She was a direct descendant of Yisro. So he merited to have Moshe as a son-in-law, and he also merited to have some of his descendants sit in the Sanhedrin. What about Eov? But when Pharaoh asked Eov what should be done with the Jews, he was silent. He says, you know, I've got no opinion on the matter. Nothing, you've got nothing to say. So the Medrash says, because of his silence, he was punished by terrible physical suffering, which, as is detailed, plague and illness and suffering, as is detailed in the book of Eov. That's what the Medrash says. So the Medrash says, because he was silent and he refused to express an opinion to Pharaoh, he was neutral on the matter. He didn't really care what happens to the Jews. And for that, he was punished with terrible physical suffering. So the Brisker Rav asked the question like this. He says, what's the connection between Eov's silence in this Medrash, in this story, with speaking to Pharaoh, and the physical torture he had to bear later on in life that caused him to cry out in agony from his pain, from his physical pain? And we see in the book of Eov, he cried. He was in so much pain, he cried out. He says, so what's the connection between being silent, not expressing an opinion, and the punishment for that is pain? We can understand Bilam. Bilam was punished midi keneged midi, right? He says, kill all the Jews, so ended up being killed himself. Yisro says, don't kill all the Jews, so he became Jewish. He got he had the reward, he became Jewish, and he had his children sat amongst the Jews in the Sanhedrin as the leaders of Israel. But says the Brisker Rav, what's silence, Eov's silence, got to do? Why, just as a result of his silence, did he have to suffer such physical agony that he cried out so loud? So he says, after all, says the Brisker Rav, Eov could readily have justified his silence with the claim that a defense of the Jews would have fallen on deaf ears. Listen, it doesn't matter what I say, Eov could have argued. If Pharaoh wants to kill them, he'll kill them. If he doesn't want to kill them, he won't kill them. And so, you know, it's not my business. I'll just keep quiet. So the Brisker Rav says like this. Listen to what the Brisker Rav says here. Before I give an answer, there's someone that's got questions. Chats. Plague Job, Egypt, at time of Moshe. Yeah, that's what I just said. Some say Job was an advisor to you of her. All right, okay. So the Brisker Rav says this. This is the Brisker Rav. He says there's a strong parallel between the punishment Eov received and his silence in front of the Pharaoh. When one suffers from pain, crying out doesn't help to remove the source of the pain. But one cries out nevertheless, because as the Brisker Rav says, and he said this in Yiddish, as shtut veishreit me, when it hurts, you cry. Even though, you know, if you know someone sticks a needle in you, just crying out doesn't take the needle out, right? It just, or someone sticks a sword in you, just crying out in pain doesn't take the sword away or cure you. But he says, "Shtut veishreit me." When it hurts, you cry, even though just crying out doesn't do any good. Says the Brisker Rav, Yoav's silence in front of Pharaoh was indicative of the fact that the potential suffering of the Jewish people in Egypt didn't really bother him. Because if it did bother him, he would have cried out to Pharaoh to have mercy on the Jews. If something or an idea or something that happens to you hurts you, you cry out. If somebody is about to hurt somebody else, you don't just look away and be silent. You're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to be neutral. You've got to do something about it. You've got to cry out. This is one of the things that separates Judaism from the Western liberal democratic approach to jurisprudence. Judaism does not allow for the right to remain silent. In Jewish law, we've got a different maxim. We've got a different level of jurisprudence. It's called shtika kahodah. If you're quiet, it's an admission of guilt or condoning of evil. You're not allowed to keep quiet. And if you go to in England, well, certainly in America, you got the right to remain silent. If you choose to give up the right to remain silent, anything you say can and will be used in evidence against you. Blah blah blah. A lawyer will be surprised. You have a right to speak to a lawyer, etc., etc. In England, the Miranda is slightly different. You've got the right to remain silent, but it may harm your defense if you fail to mention now something you later rely on in court. That's the change of the difference between the Miranda in the United States and the Miranda in the UK. But in Judaism, there's no right to silence. If you're in court and the dayan asks you a question, you've got to answer it. You've not got no Fifth Amendment right to keep quiet on the grounds that if you spoke, you might incriminate yourself. There's no right of that in Judaism. Shtika kahoda. If you're silent when the dayan asks you a question, it's as if you've admitted guilt or you're condoning evil. So it says the Brisker Rav like this. Eov didn't cry out about the pain that would be visited on the Jews in Egypt and how they would have to cry out in pain because of the terrible oppression that would be visited on them by the Egyptians in the time of slavery, because it wouldn't be his pain. It didn't bother him. It didn't. So what? So the Jews are in pain. Who cares? I'm not in pain. So who needs to shout out? Who needs to cry out in pain? It would be in someone else's pain. So it says the Brisker Rav, midah keneged midah, measure for measure. God taught him a lesson. He would eventually be forced to cry out in pain over his own trauma to teach him the lesson he should have learned or he should have known at the time when he was advising Pharaoh. And the reason being that his original silence in front of the Pharaoh indicated he was incapable of feeling the pain of others, which is, again, a tremendously powerful Jewish concept that is enshrined in halacha. Never mind as an ethical value, it's enshrined in halacha. You're required to feel the pain of other people, not just Jews. You're required to feel the pain of everybody. And as a result of not feeling the pain, he couldn't care less. In Jewish law, he was actually condoning the violence and the persecution and everything else that the Jews suffered in Egypt. He condoned it. And as we said, Judaism demands that we feel sympathy, empathy with the pain of others. And here is the parallel again. So that's why that's the reason, says the Brisker Rav, that he ended up crying out in pain to teach him a lesson, what happened when he was silent, when he went, when he had this conversation with Pharaoh. Well, do what you like. I don't care. Nothing to do with me. And says the Brisker Rav, here is the parallel between Eov and the Jews of Yerushalayim at the end of the first temple period. This is what the Jews should have learned. There were plenty of clean living righteous people living in Yehuda and living in Yerushalayim when the Babylonians came. But just like Eov, They became equally to blame for the ensuing tragedy, for the destruction, the burning of the city, the destruction of the temple, and the exile that ensued that followed that, and that they just didn't care about what was going on around them. They kept their mouths shut. The paganism, the sexual impropriety, the corruption, the violent gangs that were going on in Yerushalayim, that all the other people in Yerushalayim were indulging in these pagan activities, as we've discussed in great detail earlier on in the book, and the sexual impropriety. They just kept quiet. They didn't object. These righteous people in Yerushalayim, like Eov, were far more engrossed in living their own lives to cry out and protest that the behavior of some people would bring disaster and destruction to the whole nation. But as we just mentioned, that's not the Jewish way. And as we discussed this earlier on in the book as well, silence in the face of evil is not an option. In Judaism, again, there's no right to remain silent. Shtika kohodo. If you're quiet, when there's evil going on around you, you're condoning it, and you're part of the problem. So these clean, living, righteous people in Yerushalayim, Yehuda and Yerushalayim, are going to be in for a rude awakening. Because when the Babylonians arrive, these uninterested observers, righteous people, right, in their own lives, observant Jews, who just observed the evil that went on around them for years, will suffer along with everybody else, just like Eov did. Their silence will bring destruction, tragedy, the sword, famine, disease, exile on them in the same way that it will engulf the wicked. And this is exactly what happened to Eov. And says the Brisker Rav, here is the Nimshel, the clean, living, silent, righteous majority of Yehuda, just like Eov, with their silence became part of the problem. They, like Eov, could have been part of the solution by speaking out and objecting to all the evil that was going on around them. Instead, like Eov, they chose to remain silent. And like Eov, they would suffer the fate of the silent, and be just like Eov did, the fate of the silent, and be forced to cry out in pain. But, unlike Eov, to no avail. They would suffer exactly the same. They would suffer famine, they would suffer the soldiers, they'd suffer the plague, they'd suffer everything. Everything that came in Yerushalayim, all four curses, they would suffer in the same way that the wicked people of Yerushalayim. The only positive to take from this analysis, says the Brisker Rav, although Eov was forced to cry out in pain and he lost everything he had, he lost his family, he lost his assets, he lost his health, but just like the people of Yehuda and Yerushalayim, they lost everything under the Babylonian onslaught. Nevertheless, Eov was eventually rehabilitated. He regained his health, he recovered his wealth, and he married again and brought up a new family. Similarly, the surviving Jews of Yehuda, the surviving Jews of Yerushalayim, would also be rehabilitated in the Babylonian exile, as we've discussed on many occasions. It gave rise to the first great Baal Teshuva movement, and that started the rehabilitation of the Jewish people in the Babylonian exile. And just like Eov, they would eventually return home to the land of Israel. Just like Eov returned home, they would rebuild their lives, just like Eov did. They would rebuild Yerushalayim, their home, just like Eov did. And the second Beis HaMikdash would stand for 420 years. And suddenly when Eov was attacked by the Satan, he was 70 years old. After he recovered and was rehabilitated, he lived twice that long. He lived another 140 years, which meant he lived a total of 210 years, which is, I don't know if it's significant, but that's the entire time the Jews were enslaved in Egypt. Not the entire time the Jews were in Egypt, but it's certainly the entire time that the Jewish people were in servitude in Egypt. So these are the parallels. This is the parallel here, this third category of punishment, the category of plague, disease, pandemic that came to Yerushalayim, and it's a parallel to the life of Eov. As if I mentioned in Shia the other day, I'm not going to go through it now again, but there's a huge parallel between the life of Eov and the history of the Jewish people. Somebody should write a PhD on the parallels in the book of Eov that parallel the history of the Jewish people, and how maybe it's just a, or not just, but it's a tale of the Jewish people that has a good ending, that has a happy ending. In the Jewish world, the happy ending is the coming of the Mashiach. In Eov's case, it's the rehabilitation and the return home and the rebuilding of a new family, which is essentially the idea of the Jews coming home and rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash and rebuilding a new family. Anyway, that's maybe somebody should write a PhD on that subject. So those are the four curses that are going to come to Yerushalayim. And God uses these three characters of Noach, Daniel, and Eov to parallel the idea that God's anger here. That generally speaking, even if these three guys would have been in Yerushalayim, these superstars of Jewish history, they would have only ever been able to save themselves. Everybody else would have gone. There's an interesting question raised here in this chapter by the Abarbanel that needs answering. So I think we'll finish with this. We'll ask the question and we'll give the answer next week. So we'll finish. So we're at the point where we're going to start with some good news. I mean, this whole chapter at the moment has been dealing with bad news, right? Been dealing with the fact that these four curses are going to come on Yerushalayim, which we knew about already, famine, the animal that's going to come, the wild animal, Nebuchadnezzar, the sword, you're going to bring the sword with him, and it's going to lead to disease and death and destruction, etc., etc., etc. All four of God's primary categories of curse. But there's one question here before we move on, and we're going to move on to a bit of good news with the next verse. And it's the question that the Abarbanel raises here. Lama zecha shloshes anofim ha'ela Noach, Daniel, ve'Eov. He says, why does God specifically use the example of these three to parallel what's going to happen in Yerushalayim? That had these three in particular been there, they would have been able to save themselves. They wouldn't have been able to save their children. To give an insight into the fact that nothing really can save Yerushalayim, not even the presence of the righteous. He says, Lama zocha shloshes anoshim ha'ela Noach, Daniel, ve'Eov. V'lo zocha ashar tzadikim. If we remember earlier on, Rashi said at the beginning of the chapter, that the reason why Noach, Daniel, and Eov are given as examples is because they were people like the people in Yerushalayim. They had seen the world bonui, chorav ubonui. They'd seen the world built up. They'd seen Yerushalayim become one of the most affluent and powerful cities in the world. Then they saw it destroyed, and the survivors saw it rebuilt again. And Noach, Daniel, and Eov, they had a life. Their lives were pretty much like that. Noach saw the world through the period after Adam and after Adam's death, the world being built and colonized, a bad word, and being built up. Then he saw it destroyed, and then after the flood, he saw it rebuilt again. Daniel again, he saw Yerushalayim in all its glory, and then he saw it destroyed, and then he saw it rebuilt again. And Eov as well. He, on a personal level, Eov saw himself become a great person, wealthy, affluent, charitable. He had everything going for him. Then he lost everything. Chorav, he lost everything, and then he was rehabilitated. So they are a parallel to what happens to Yerushalayim. He says, but says the Barbanav, lo zocha shal tzadikim shiro churban olam in v'chayehem. He says, why these three? There are plenty of people. And he gives an example. The example he gives is Ki'ilu Toma Lot. What about Lot? Now, Lot gets a bit of quite a lot of bad press. Lot is Avram's nephew. Is Avram's nephew, right? Sharah Chorban Saddam. He became very, very wealthy. Then Sharah Chorban Saddam. He became very wealthy with Avram Avinu, and he went south into the plain. In the south, Kegan Hashem Ke Eretz Mitzrayim, like into where the Dead Sea is today, but at that time it was Kegan Hashem, it was like a garden of God, and so he became very wealthy, and then Sharah Chorban Saddam, and then he had to witness the destruction of Saddam, and then afterwards he was rescued and he rebuilt himself. So the Barbanel says to him, Toma, Shalot, Hitzeles Benosov. And if you want to say that Lot is excluded from this list, because he succeeded in saving his daughters, unlike the ideas brought forward here by Yecheskel, that had these three guys, Noach, Daniel, and Iyo, been in Yerushalayim, they wouldn't have been able to save their children. He says, then Noach should be excluded, because when push came to shove, when the flood came, he did save his children, so he's not a great parallel to this story. But this guy can. And yet he is remembered here. He's brought in as an example here. So what makes Noach a better example than Lot? And there's other examples as well. But this is the example the Barbanel brings. He says, why is Noah included? If you're going to make a list, so make a list of them all. So you have plenty of people that, went through life and they built themselves up. They created a great life for themselves, and then everything was destroyed, and then they rebuilt it. They were rehabilitated. You can name loads of people. Without the obvious examples of Moshe Rabbeinu, and who was brought up in the palace of the Pharaoh, and then had to flee, and then rose to the highest point that a human being could rise to. Not to mention Naomi, who was from the farm, married to the Nossi, the prince of the tribe of Yehuda. And then they lost, they had everything going for them, living in Beis Lechem. Then they lost everything. And their sons married Shixes, and her sons died. And then she was rehabilitated, and she came back to the land of Israel, and her daughter-in-law converted, and she gave birth to a child who eventually would give birth to David and Muhammad. I mean, there's plenty of examples. So the Abarbanel says, what about Lot? And if you want to say, Hitzelus Benosov, well, he's not on the list, because this list is about people that would only be able to save themselves and not be able to save their children. Well, if Noah saved his children, he saved his daughters-in-law, he saved his wife. So he's included, so why isn't Lot included? So this is the kasha of the Abarbanel. And please God, next week we'll answer that question. Why specifically these three? And then, please God, we'll move on. We'll move on to... That is the dark part of this chapter. And next week, please God, we'll move on to a brighter end to the chapter, which is more comforting. So that's it for this week. Thanks, everybody, for taking part. Let me see what the comments are here. Mark says, nothing has changed. Zandmoji, Jews in America. Lot was not regarded as a tzaddik, whereas the others were. Yes, he was. Yes, he was. Lot was regarded as a tzaddik. Anyway, let's, if you look in the Gemara in Sota, so you'll see he was up to the point where... You'll have to read that. I'm not going to discuss the story in the Goran Sartre. It gets a bit explicit. But yes, he was considered to be a tzaddik. Okay, that's it for this week. We'll see you all, please God, in health and happiness. Everyone should have a good week, Shavua Tov, and a Gitavoch, and we should only hear good news from our soldiers and everybody else. Kol Tov to everybody, have a great week. Kol Tov.